from deep inside your radio.
Well, goodbye to Springfield, Illinois, and hello to Moscow, Idaho. You know, the door opens, the door closes. One affiliate arrives, another affiliate departs. But Springfield, we're going to miss you. We may name a cartoon town after you. Don't worry about it. Ladies and gentlemen, the New York Times tries so, and Moscow. I'm on radio in Moscow. You know? I guess we won the Cold War, is all I can say. Ladies and gentlemen, the New York Times does try so very, very hard to stay with it, whatever it is, and whatever it with is. I guess it all depends on what your definition of with it is with it. Couple weeks ago, on the front page, mind you, of the New York Times, there was a story about discovering the surprising news to them that DJs were getting big money now for so-called concert appearances. That is to say, live appearances where they showed up, where they show up, and so do hundreds, thousands of fans, and large amounts of money are exchanged, funds transferred into the accounts of said DJs. And I guess the news story was, you know, they're making the kind of money that, in another era, bands used to make. And that's as far as they took it. I, on the other hand, went a little farther back and a little farther forward, just looking at it as a linear development. In the 1930s and 40s, it took 18 or 19 musicians on stage to entertain an audience of hundreds or thousands. In the 1960s and 70s and 80s, it took five or six guys or gals on stage to entertain the same size audience. Today, it takes one dude standing at a computer to entertain an audience of that size. So if you just figure that it's a linear development, you know where it's going to be in 10 years. We'll still be entertained in the hundreds and thousands, and all we'll have done is eliminated the humans. Ladies and gentlemen, speaking of the New York Times, this week's really best correction in the journalistic world comes from the Times. And this post has been revised, says the Times, to reflect the following correction. An earlier version of this story misstated the title of a film released by Paramount Vantage. It is There Will Be Blood, not There Were Blood. That's from the New York Times. I guess somebody was thinking about gang wars. Somebody must be a Crip at the Times. I'd check that out first thing. Ladies and gentlemen, now news of the godly. Nothing from Philadelphia this week, but let's hopscotch the world over to Ireland. Ireland's most senior cleric, Cardinal Sean Brady, said this week his role in a 1975 investigation into pedophile Brendan Smythe had been exaggerated. The primate faced renewed demands to resign after it emerged that a then 14-year-old victim of Smythe's warned the primate, Brady, in secret interviews that it was likely the late priest, Smythe, was abusing five other named children. That is to say, children in Ireland have names. The cardinal said his role in the inquiry had been deliberately exaggerated and misrepresented in a BBC documentary aired this week. I deeply regret that those with the authority and responsibility to deal appropriately with Brendan Smythe failed to do so, with tragic and painful consequences for those children he so cruelly abused, the cardinal said in a statement. The Vatican's chief investigator insisted Cardinal Brady has no cause to answer and fulfilled his duties by referring information on child abuse to his seniors, rather than, say, to the civil authorities, you see. 3 years ago, when allegations about Cardinal Brady's role in the inquiry into Smythe emerged, he said he would resign if he found his actions or failings had led to another child being abused. He interviewed two of Smythe's young victims under a special canon oath, while a 33-year-old priest, he said he regretted the church's response was so inadequate. I was shocked, appalled, and outraged when I first discovered in the mid-1990s that Brendan Smythe had gone on to abuse others. I feel betrayed that those who had the authority in the church to stop Brendan Smythe failed to act on the evidence I gave them. However, he says in his statement. I also affect that I was part, except I was part of an unhelpful culture of deference and silence in society and the church, which thankfully now is a thing of the past. The primate's role in point of the evidence which revealed that he had names and addresses of children who were suspected of being abused during the inquiry, those named children, those other named children, the primate's role has been described by the church as a note taker, purely administrative, to pass the information on to his superiors. The youngster's parents were not involved. And by the way, although he said, I knew chapter and verse of what was going on, this is a quote, I didn't have the awareness I now have of the impact that behavior, i.e. abuse, was having on the children. Unquote. Didn't know child abuse could be a bad thing for the kids. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of Hello, Welcome to the Show. from New Orleans, Louisiana, right by Lake Pontchartrain. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. First, from the Guardian newspaper in London, the last man sentenced to be hanged in the United Kingdom has won permission. He hasn't been hanged yet, has won permission to appeal against his conviction for murdering a soldier in Northern Ireland after evidence emerged of British Army use of waterboarding during interrogations in the 1970s. Prosecutors offered no objection to the appeal by Liam Holden, whose 1973 conviction for murdering a member of the parachute regiment was based on confession he said was extracted under torture that included waterboarding. That's where we got the idea. His legal team cited fresh evidence unearthed by the Guardian reporter about the use of waterboard torture techniques, or they're torture, are they, by the military at the time. The material by the reporter, which will form part of a book covering the British military's use of torture from the Second World War onwards, was significant in securing the appeal. Said the lawyer, my client welcomes the decision by the Director of Public Prosecutions not to oppose the referral. He's been protesting his innocence for almost 40 years. The allegation of torture was first made by him in his trial in 1973. The Public Prosecution Service said that fresh evidence concerning the circumstances of his detention by the Army was central to the decision not to oppose the appeal. The jury refused to believe Holden's claim that he only confessed to the fatal shooting under torture and duress. The court of trial was deprived of the relevant material that might have led to a different outcome on the question of admissibility of the incriminating statements, because information regarding the torture of Holden had not been made available during the trial. See, that's why we keep it all secret now. Even the trials. Speaking of which, the former chief U.S. prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay has denounced the military trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged 9/11 mastermind, as intended primarily to prevent the defendants from presenting evidence of torture. See how it keeps going? Morris Davis, a former colonel who was chief prosecutor when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was brought to Guantanamo in 2006, said the military commissions will be badly discredited by the use of testimony obtained from waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques used on the accused men. This also from The Guardian in London. I don't know whether it's been in a paper here. I haven't seen it here. Davis, who resigned from being chief U.S. prosecutor at Gitmo over the issue, wanted to see President Obama follow through on his commitment to move the trials to more open civilian courts. But he said advocates of military tribunals prevailed in large part because the rules of evidence prevent the defendants from giving detailed descriptions of how they were tortured, as well as other sensitive information, such as details of the CIA's secret detention program and the cooperation of foreign countries such as Britain. See how it all ties in? Quote, the truth is the reason the apologists want a second-rate military commission option is because of what we did to the detainees, not because of what the detainees did to us. Unquote, Morris Davis, the former chief U.S. prosecutor at Guantanamo. It's not like it's, Alec Baldwin saying this. Quote, if you look beneath the layers on why there's even an argument for military commissions, it's really about our mistreatment of detainees, a fairly small number of people for a short period of time, that because of what most people would call torture, it makes it a greater challenge to prosecute the cases in our regular courts. Unquote. Other senior military lawyers have objected to the trials, including Rear Admiral Donald Guter, the former chief judge advocate general of the Navy, who called the Guantanamo commissions a circus. Well, who doesn't like a circus? The clowns are scary, but aside from that, military tribunal rules forbid discussion of torture and other sensitive information. The public and press are kept behind a glass screen at Guantanamo, and the proceedings they hear are subject to a 40-second delay so censors can block testimony the government does not want made public. By the way, President Obama, you may be aware, made some changes in the military commissions. they do not allow a defendant's own confessions under torture to be used against him. Well, that's a, we can breathe a sigh of, oh, but the statements of others who were tortured can be used, which permits the interrogations of the accused to be used against each other. Five accused at the Gitmo trial were held incommunicado for several years by the CIA, which subjected Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as you may know, to waterboarding 183 times. The International Red Cross described the conditions they underwent as inducing severe physical and mental pain and suffering with the aim of obtaining compliance. As you may remember, you may remember the John Yoo torture memo said it was okay to do stuff to people as long as the pain they experienced was not equivalent to organ failure. Davis said the trials, but going back to the article, former U.S. Chief Prosecutor Guantanamo Bay, Morris Davis. My greatest concern is that we give a stamp of approval to this second-rate process, that in the future, if the shoe's ever on the other foot, if an American GI or a citizen are being prosecuted in a second-rate procedure somewhere else around the world, we've given up the moral argument that it's inadequate. He continued, in January, you had an American citizen, Amir Hekmati, doesn't sound American to me, convicted in an Iranian court and sentenced to death. Victoria Nuland of our State Department in a press conference condemned the conviction and said the procedure was not the same as Iranian citizens get. There was secret proceeding. There was coerced evidence. There was inadequate defense. I'm listening to her talking, says Davis, and I'm thinking that sounds an awful lot like the military commissions in Guantanamo. I think we really do give up the right to object when other people do what we're doing. And finally, from outside the bubble, airline passengers may soon be subject to further full-body scans after a report for the European Commission concluded that the security devices posed negligible risks to health, if not dignity. In November, the Commission suspended any further implementation of backscatter scanners, the X-ray ones we have here, amid fears they could emit harmful levels of cancer-causing radiation. Manchester Airport is the only one in Europe using the devices, or at least experimenting with them, as an alternative to less intrusive millimeter wave scans. American passengers can opt out of scans in favor of a pat-down search. However, in Britain, they've ruled that passengers who refuse the scanners are not allowed to fly, and 23 passengers have been denied boarding in Manchester since the technology was introduced in 2009. So if you don't want to be X-rayed, don't be going to Manchester. And by the way, another report on the safety of the X-ray scanners has one quite interesting passage. It says they cannot credibly be believed to cause any harm if used as designed, if operated as they're supposed to be. Which begs the question, people who get 2 weeks of training and are paid $15 an hour, really? If that's good enough, then the radiology lab technicians around the country are being drastically overpaid. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the Olympic movement. My goodness, we're less than 2,012 hours away. And it's still produced by Jim Ebersol Jr. The Olympics will not turn London into Siege City, despite plans to deploy surface-to-air missiles on residential buildings and fighter jets in the skies. That's from London 2012 Chairman Sebastian Coe. Call him Seb. Speaking at the Olympic Stadium at the start of a week of test events that coincide with a major Olympic security exercise in London, Coe assured reporters that the right balance would be found. Let me make it really clear. The challenge of delivering the right level of security in Olympic Games is not just simply about how you can lock down everything. We're inviting people to come to London to celebrate the greatest sporting event that this country has ever seen. We are not inviting people to Siege City. Some residents of an apartment block overlooking the Olympic Park complex in East London have been alarmed in recent days to discover that their building is a proposed site for a rooftop missile battery. Others have questioned the deployment of missiles in city center locations, arguing that they pose an unnecessary risk to civilians, give terrorists more respect than they deserve, and dent the Olympic spirit. Coe said organizers would be guided by the experts on security and were satisfied that, quote, the right people are making the right decisions. That's always a good default position, Seb. And, yes, there's more Olympic news. And it may deserve its own music. We'll see. At a central London sports center, six hairy legs emerged from a swimming pool in time to a beat before coquettishly disappearing again. This is Britain's only men's synchronized swimming team, and they want to know why men are barred from the sport at the Olympics. A group of men in sequin trunks has set out to disprove claims that this year's Olympic Games has broken down the last bastion of sporting sexism. London 2012 organizers claimed this would be the first Games which made all sports available to men and women, but the Out to Swim Angels disagree. Men are still barred from competing in synchronized swimming, despite the fact that members of the team have won international events at the highest level. Yes, it's real. America has twice seen men succeed in international contests only to be knocked back for Olympic qualification because it is a woman-only sport. In training, the team wears standard trunks, but for competition, they have specially adapted pants with sequined angel wings on the back. Their next competitive swim is against the men's team in Paris at the end of this month. In this modern world, says a spokesperson, it's time to move beyond the arbitrary preconceptions we have of certain types of sport. Says an Olympic spokeswoman, synchronized swimming is one of the last few examples of a discipline not open to both men and women. A whole generation of athletes needs to be created to compete at Olympic level, and this will take time. It may need to start out as a demonstration sport to raise its profile, but the issue of placing rather arbitrary gender restrictions on Olympic sports must be challenged. Derde Esposito, who originally is from Cuba, is the star of the Angels Club. He says synchronized swimming for men is quite common in Cuba. They call it aquatic ballet. My favorite move is the ballet leg, where you stick your leg out of the water. Ronan Daly is the tallest and burliest of the team. He says, most people can't believe I do it, but it's great fun. I told my partner as a joke that the only time I'd consider swimming was if the club did synchro. And then when they started doing it, I had to give it a go. Yes, real life imitates satire. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the Olympic spirit. The Olympics, it's a movement. And we all need one every day. Men synchro guys, don't give up. Just begin again.
Square one. Just begin again.
Yeah, that's how it ends. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show. And as you know, the President of the United States made an unannounced trip this week to Kabul, Afghanistan, to sign a deal with the Afghan government, with President Karzai. And one could be pardoned and then re-imprisoned. One could be pardoned for being a bit confused about what the terms of the deal were and are, because the headlines seem to indicate that this was the beginning of the end of our more than 10-year involvement in Afghanistan. But if you read down, way down 3-4 paragraphs, it turns out that the agreement was specifying that we're going to stick around there in some way, shape, or form, militarily, at least through 2024. Not ending in 2014. So, are we leaving? Are we staying? Is it the end? Is it the end of the beginning? Is it the beginning of the end? These are questions that really can't be answered authoritatively here in the Le Show Dome. I think we have to switch control to our sister network.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where the pledge drive never ends. From the newly fortified presidential palace in downtown Kabul, where even the explosive devices are improvised. I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid.
We're Kash and Ash, the Fork It Over brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk. Today's show comes to you with the help of Pakistan, the prestige address for insurgents worldwide.
But hey, we don't have to worry about them, my older brother.
No, we will not be alone in this treacherous neighborhood with Iranians on one side, Russians on another.
And the best Indian restaurants in the world, just a short 8-hour jeep ride away. Speaking of the neighborhood, listeners have probably noticed that almost all Afghan men wear beards.
That's true.
They may have wondered whether it's some kind of religious thing.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
Of course. The real reason is if you try to shave, the electricity cuts out before you're halfway through.
Yeah, and then you've got almost all Afghan men wearing half beards. But, you know, we could go on like this until we get sick of us.
Don't laugh. It's already happened.
Don't tell me don't laugh. It's in the format. But we have an actual guest on today's program in our actual studio.
That's right. All of a sudden, we're like the Hindu Kush home companion.
He flew here earlier this week on a secret, unannounced visit. He went back home to do some governing and some campaigning. And now he's flown back to be our unannounced guest. President Barack Obama, welcome to Karzai Talk.
Well, thanks, Hamid. I came back because I want to learn how not to raise money like your brother.
And how not to govern like my brother.
I do have to say, the studio seems kind of tiny. The exterior of the building looks much bigger.
Yes, that's 20 feet of blast wall.
But we're very grateful for your agreeing with my brother to end the war on the long track.
Mm-hmm. I think you mean the very long track.
Yes, my friend, with the full knowledge that our American brothers will be here for another 12 years, I think we can have the certainty we need for Afghan free enterprise to flourish.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Oh, yes, I've gotten 3 more orders for Toyota Tundras just since the agreement was signed.
Wow. Well, that's great.
Unfortunately, the orders are from the Taliban, but hey, their money is as bad as anyone else's.
seriously, Hamid, I'm here to say that we're not leaving you this time. Mm-hmm. We're not abandoning you. Mm-hmm. We're living up to our responsibilities, and we expect
that we won't kill you all.
That would be nice.
Hello, you're on Karzai Talk with President Obama.
Hello, Mr. President. This is Salahuddin, first-time caller. First name caller.
Hey, Salahuddin. Who do you like in the NBA final?
Well, Miami looks unbeatable in the east, but... Oh, sorry, I need to stay on topic. There's a man with a gun at my head.
Okay, well, then we'll take a rain check on who you like in the west. What's your question?
Well, this is for Mahmoud, really, but I'm just to assume, am I not, that the agreement for the Americans to stay means that our transportation routes for our almonds will continue to be protected?
I believe it's safe to say that.
I know it's safe to say that, but is it safe for our almonds to be transported as usual?
Well, I don't know specifically about almonds.
They're not really talking about almonds.
I understand. But the cornerstone of this agreement is our reliance on a stronger and more reliable Afghan army and police force.
You are kidding, right?
Well,
now you've heard the jokes on this show. You must know we're never kidding.
Thanks for the call. Mr. President, I know you can't stay much longer due to the fact that once people know you're here, you have to leave. But
well, I just want to take the opportunity to say that programs like this are such a great example.
There are no other programs like this. This is the only one like this.
All right, then. This program is such a great example of the free and open society which we're trying to help you build. I don't think that the Taliban leaders would go on the radio and just put any callers on the air.
Oh, no, they certainly wouldn't.
It would be stupid for them to do so.
Yes.
That's why we have screeners and plants.
Well, they're doing a great job. Thanks, fellas.
Goodbye, Mr. President. No more calls, please. The phone lines have been ripped out for security reasons.
Headphones with you. You paid for them.
We had help for today's Cars I Talk from the Nation Building Foundation. When you can't build homes, build nations.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum and Lucum.
I'm Hamid. Join me and my younger and more business-like brother Mahmoud next time for another edition of Cars I Talk.
This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The Associated Press News Agency has apologized for firing a reporter who broke the news that World War II had ended a day before the agreed embargo. Ed Kennedy defied the military censors to report the Nazi surrender on the night of May 7th, 1945. The U.S. and Britain had agreed to suppress the announcement for a day so Russia could stage a second surrender ceremony in Berlin. AP has now said that Kennedy did the right thing in breaking the embargo. He was one of 17 reporters taken to witness the formal surrender of European troops. German troops. The group were sworn to secrecy by U.S. military commanders, told not to report the news until a full 38 hours later. But when Kennedy heard that the German radio had announced the surrender, he went ahead and published his story an hour later, a day ahead of the competition. The absurdity of attempting to bottle up news of such magnitude was too apparent, he said. He died of a traffic accident in 1963 at the age of 58. His daughter, Julia, told AP she was overjoyed by the apology. I think it would have meant a lot to him, she said. No, it has nothing to do with what's going on now. We don't keep secrets these days. Dateline Miramar, Florida. A Vietnam veteran with cancer said the chief executive officer of Florida's Spirit Airlines has apologized after refusing at first to give him a refund. CEO Ben Baldanza also issued a statement saying the airline's refund policy is part of the reason the discounted airline can keep fares low. But failing to refund dying veteran Jerry Meekins his fare was a mistake. The statement said Baldanza would personally refund the veteran's money, and the airline would donate $5,000 to the charity of his choice. The controversy began when a doctor told Meekins he should not fly. Spirit then refused to refund his $197. But that's what keeps your fares low, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you understand? An assistant Seattle police chief apologized to city council members this week for not keeping them informed about the department's plans to use aerial drones. City leaders and the public were caught by surprise last week when the ACLU raised questions about the department's planned use of two unmanned aerial vehicles it received in 2010 under a federal Homeland Security grant. This war on terror thing is Nothing but good. The Drug Enforcement Administration, speaking of fine wars, has apologized to a San Diego college student who said he drank his own urine to survive after being left in a holding cell for 5 days without food, water, or access to a toilet. This is your brain on the war on drugs. The man, 23-year-old UC San Diego engineering student Daniel Chong, was accidentally left in a holding cell after he and eight other people were detained for questioning following a raid in which agents found guns, ammunition, and an array of drugs, including 18,000 ecstasy pills. I am deeply troubled by the incident that occurred here last week, says acting special agent in charge of the DEA's San Diego division. I extend, he says, my deepest apologies to the young man. I want to express that this event is not indicative of the high standards that I hold my employees to. End quote. After processing, seven of the nine were taken to a county detention facility. One was released, and Chong was accidentally left in one of the cells, said the DEA. As days went by, Chong told NBC San Diego he kicked the door many times in a futile attempt to get agents' attention. He eventually drank his own urine to survive, began hallucinating, and tried to kill himself by breaking his glasses and cutting his wrists. When agents finally discovered him, he was taken to a hospital. The DEA said Chong told agents he'd been at the house that was raided, quote, to get high with his friends. Well, he ended up hallucinating. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter apologized this week to a local newspaper columnist after his press secretary tweeted a rumor that she had unpaid parking tickets. Daily News columnist Ronnie Polineski has written frequently about issues related to the Philadelphia, there you see, parking authority. Last week, Nutter's chief spokesperson posted a rhetorical question on Twitter implying that she should have disclosed her previous parking tickets. Said the mayor, the tweet was a mistake. He would personally apologize to her. I want to apologize to her directly on behalf of the city government and our administration, he said. Only in America can you elect a man named Nutter, mayor. No, it's good. Organizers of a high school journalism convention apologized for a speech by columnist and gay rights advocate Dan Savage, which prompted a walkout by about 100 of the teenage attendees. The address was not what our organizations expected, said the joint press release by the sponsors, the National Scholastic Press Association and the Journalism Education Association. It added, we consider Mr. Savage's use of harsh language and profanity to be inappropriate and offensive to many in the audience. He was addressing anti-gay bullying in a crowd of about 2,800 high school students in Seattle. We can learn to ignore the bull in the Bible about gay people, Savage told the high school students. He went on to call the Bible a radically pro-slavery document and referred to the walkout as pansy-assed. In his blog Sunday, Savage himself apologized for that last comment. Dateline Dallas, two Texas men were exonerated this week in a nearly 30-year-old rape and shooting case after DNA tests in Dallas County implicated others in the crime. Judge Susan Hawk apologized to James Curtis Williams and Raymond Jackson after she declared both men formally innocent of aggravated sexual assault. They were convicted in 1983 and sentenced to life in prison. Both men were recently paroled. I hope that you feel like justice was served for you today, said the judge. Dallas County has exonerated 32 people since 2001, most of them during the tenure of Dallas County District Attorney Craig Watkins. Most of the cases involve faulty eyewitness identifications. Says Watkins, who is black, I think we see the similarities in these men and the two that are being exonerated today that has not been addressed. We need to address that here in Dallas County. We are doing something wrong with our criminal justice system, and we need to fix it, unquote, the Dallas County DA. A student at Wesleyan University has apologized after posting flyers on campus that read, no colored people were allowed in the school student union. They were posted during an international celebration on the campus. The Asian Student Association was presenting the celebration of Holi, a Hindu holiday observed in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Known as the Festival of Colors, the holiday is often celebrated by people throwing colored paint and powder at each other. Organizers were concerned that students covered in the paint and powder could make a mess inside the student union, so senior Catherine Y. posted the flyers that read, no colored people, but seriously, if you're covered in colored powder, you can't come in. She said, this was my fault, and I want to take 100% responsibility for it. The above poster occurred to me as a joke. I'm not sure why the obvious inoffensive of it inoffensiveness of it didn't hit me in the face immediately, and I'm deeply, deeply regretful that I ever printed these. I guess she needs more colored paint to hit her in the face immediately. It would be the clue there, ladies and gentlemen. Might be, I would suggest, to the listening audience. Further, Cyndi Lauper apologized for using an expletive that was caught by a microphone prior to a short performance in the run-up to the Pegasus Parade in Louisville, Kentucky. She said it happened out of frustration over technical difficulties. She just wanted to have fun. Major League Soccer, really? This week apologized for statements made by a radio host, Simon Borg, concerning women fans on his radio podcast. Borg will be suspended 7 days and will undergo diversity and sensitivity training. A designer for Nike made an ill-timed quip on Twitter last week, speculating that Derrick Rose's torn ACL might have had something to do with his shoe choice. Rose tore out his left knee, blew out his left knee. He is a Adidas athlete. The tweet referred to LeBron James, who's a Nike athlete and has continued in the playoffs. The designer, Jason Petrie, he is the designer of LeBron James' shoe. He took to Twitter to apologize for his remarks. I do apologize. It was really just tongue-in-cheek. Never meant any harm or disrespect. Nike called the tweet inappropriate. And Sir Martin Sorrell, one of Britain's leading businessmen, has condemned his own advertising group for shooting a controversial Argentina propaganda video showing one of their Olympic hopefuls exercising on a Falklands War memorial. He said the 90-second film was totally unacceptable. He was appalled and embarrassed by it. He said the subsidiary that made it had formally apologized for any offense or pain caused. The ad was made by Y&R agency I used to work for, based in Buenos Aires. The ad is totally, and I mean totally, unacceptable, he said. And it was criticized by the International Olympic Committee. So now you know it was bad. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. So very much a copyrighted feature of this program. Now, follow the dollar. You know, we hear all the time on radio and television and in the newspapers, analysts explaining why the stock market did this or that. You know, the stock market went down because of concerns about unemployment figures, or the stock market went up because of encouragement that the European situation is getting better. Well, you won't hear that anytime soon. And you might wonder, well, how do these people know why the stock market did what it did? Do they talk to 8 investors? Do they just intuit the motivations of the market going up and down? So you might wonder, what is going on in today's stock market? For some edification on the subject, here's an excerpt from a recent oration by Andrew Haldane. He is the Director of Financial Stability, good luck to you, babe, at the Bank of England. And after he's finished, you may understand a little bit more why there are no more day traders. Andrew Haldane, follow the dollar.
Let me talk about the speed race, because that's one that's been playing out and is still playing out over the last 10 years or so. You back up 20 years, and trade execution times in financial markets were measured in minutes. You back up 10 years, and those trade execution times were measured in seconds. You back up 5 years, and those trade execution times were measured in milliseconds. You look at today, and trading execution is measured in microseconds, in millionths of a second. Tomorrow, it will be nanoseconds, billionths of a second. The day after tomorrow, it could well be picoseconds, trillionths of a second. It has given rise, we've seen the rise over the last 10 years of this phenomenon that is high-frequency trading. Those traders now dominate many of our mainstream financial markets, accounting for anywhere between a half and three-quarters of volumes transacted, for example, in the world's major equity markets. One reason they dominate volumes is because they submit huge volumes of quotes in the market, most of which, the vast majority of which, are never exercised. The firms cancel them before they're ever exercised. So at present, for every order executed, 60 are cancelled. So what's going on here? Well, I mean, one thing that's going on is that although there are loads of quotes on the screen, if you try and hit them, they've disappeared before you can ever transact as you would wish. There is a mirage of liquidity. A second feature is that some have said this practice of putting in multiple quotes, of quote stuffing in the language, is effectively an externality. Why? Because bandwidth is a common good. Bandwidth is finite. So by quote stuffing, you are using up bandwidth and slowing down everyone else. You are imposing an externality on slow traders, which might matter a lot if prices are moving around a lot. This high-frequency trading behavior has both a mirage of liquidity effect and a externality in terms of bandwidth being used. And both of those externalities were well exemplified on the 6th of May 2010, the well-known flash crash. At that point, the mirage of liquidity was shown to be just that. The mirage disappeared before our eyes. Liquidity evaporated at speed. And what's more, bandwidth message traffic went through the roof, which meant that everyone else, those slower in the queue, those who couldn't keep up in the race, were unable to transact, and therefore there was a divergence between the prices of similar securities on different exchanges. The flash crash was no one-off. In the period since, although less publicised, there have been hundreds of mini flash crashes. The sources of those was this race, this speed race in financial markets that brings with it the externality of fragile liquidity, that brings with it the externality of order cancellation.
In economic speak, ladies and gentlemen, externality is a consequence of someone's decision or action imposed not on that person, but on somebody else. And when he says years, he meant years.
I don't feel like laughing now. I could use a laugh and how. I could use a telephone all alone. Me and my old radio. Got a lot of nerve, all right. Not what I deserve tonight. To get together, tell that so and so. Shake at the big apple tree, barking for a bite, you see. Sun is up on New York town, honking round, run down my battery. Drop me off at Walk to Flock. Another block, and it's been lovely here on Wall Street. There is just nothing but ash in the air, confetti all colored with blood, the jewel-encrusted mud, flattened hearts. She's beaten and battered and buttressed and broke, dining on tracks gone begging, no joke. And in the confetti is human desire, love letters lost in space, now smoking. The mouth of the river yawning south to the sea. Thank you.
out of disarray, though to fallen man in gray. Upside down and holding hands with his mate, why wait for speculation? Like two stones they gravitate, there's no time to hesitate, just time to say I love you. Two flaming birds on fire, they kiss their lives goodbye. Above the concrete street, we meet and die. Without a trace of our embrace, you can't place my face, though you are trying. Till dust will stop our labored love, we must drop all fear, now a fly. A heartbeat from the Hudson down to the sea.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may have noticed that this week the moon was elevated to a superhero status, at least over the weekend. Lucky it wasn't a bat moon or a spider moon, that's all I can say. That concludes this week's edition of the show, by the way. The program returns next week at the same time over the same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshear.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com and through iTunes. And it'd be just like knowing when the Afghanistan war is going to be over. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much, uh-huh. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Tom Walsh here at WWNO-FM New Orleans for helping with today's broadcast. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the almost 62,000 followers at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.